Sometimes it seems like kids are less mature than ever, and it's causing problems for parents and for teachers. What can parents do to help their kids become more mature? Find out what Dr. Gordon Neufeld thinks in part one of our interview this week on Family Anatomy.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologist.
So if you need to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you could get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. You can find us at familyanatomy.com or over on iTunes, and we are going to get right into it today because we're talking with Dr. Gordon Neufeld.
A podiatrist friend of ours.
Yes. Foot doctor, right? That's podiatrist?
Yes, that's right.
Just double checking.
No, not a podiatrist. A psychologist, in fact.
A psychologist, yes.
Someone that we saw in Toronto doing a workshop.
That's right.
From there.
We spent 2 days listening to Dr. Neufeld talk about working with stuck kids, and we were so impressed with his talk and his approach that we thought we better invite him on the show.
And so we did, and he was very gracious to say, sure, I can do that for you. And so here we are a couple of months later.
You know what? The fact is we've already spoken to his co-author on his book, right?
That's right.
Which
Dr.
is called
Gabor Maté.
Dr. Gabor Maté is the co-author of Hold On To Your Kids. Right.
And, you know, Dr. Neufeld let's just give him a little bit of a bio here. He's a developmental psychologist who has been in private practice in Vancouver for very many years. He's an internationally recognized psychologist who works with children and families. He was a professor at the University of British Columbia for 20 years. He worked with young offenders. He was a forensic psychologist for a while. And like we were just saying, he wrote a book with Dr. Gabor Maté called Hold On To Your Kids, Why Parents Need To Matter More. And we've spoken to Dr. Maté before. And so he's just come back from a speaking tour in Europe. We're very, very privileged to be able to have him on the show.
We caught him in between speaking tours, which is great. We were able to line up our schedule. So that worked out really well. And one of the reasons why we wanted to have him on the show is because his approach is pretty radically different from the kind of approaches that you and I learned when we were studying psychology and learning how to work with kids and families. When I was doing my training, and I'm sure, well, maybe when you were doing your training, it was more about cave paintings and working with bones and sticks and such things. But when I was doing my training, it was all about timeouts and consequences and rewards for positive behavior and teaching kids how to behave properly. But Dr. Neufeld doesn't talk about teaching kids how to behave properly at all.
He doesn't. And I guess back in the 40s, when you were doing those experiments with rats, I can see why you got the wrong idea. I think, you know, his approach has been along for a very long time. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's been the minority approach since, say, the mid-50s. 1950s. So,
right, when the behaviorists sort of were on the rise, right?
That's it. So it's been there all along, but it's been sort of an undercurrent, and it feels like it's starting to stick right now. It's starting to grow right now in people's consciousness.
Well, in the past 2 years, if you look at the things we've talked about just on this show and the people who we've spoken with, it's been all about relationships, all about attachment. And that's something that Dr. Neufeld talks about also.
So why don't we let him tell us more about it?
That's right. Why do you want to listen to us talk about it? Let's get Dr. Neufeld on the line.
Let's do it. Dr. Neufeld, welcome to Family Anatomy.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We're very happy that you could join us today. You know, we like to make the show personal, so I'm always curious about people's biographies. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became drawn to working with children and parents.
Well, when I first graduated with my PhD, although my doctorate was in developmental psychology, I was afraid of children. And so I thought I didn't understand those little critters at all. And so I played it safe and basically stayed with adults and in counseling, marriage counseling, and therapy, and clinical issues. And then I had my own children, and of course fell in love with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had 5 children and now 3 grandchildren. My own children are all grown. The youngest is 20 and the oldest is 41. But after that experience, I began to realize, especially as I was dealing with troubled adolescents in one of my jobs, working in the prison systems of young offenders, and they were an enigma. And I was teaching developmental psychology at university, and at the same time, I was having my own preschoolers, and I realized that the preschoolers and that the adolescent offenders were very, very similar, and began to realize that if you could make sense of children, especially young children, you probably had the keys to humanity. So that began a lifelong process of trying to put the pieces together, and it's just been a wonderful journey, actually, a 40-year journey of joining the dots and putting the pieces together and basically around the idea of making sense of kids.
And so it's all about understanding how kids and as they grow into adults, how they develop. And so you've called yourself a developmentalist. What does that mean?
Well, that term is used loosely or used in one of two ways. One way is that it means that you basically work with children, but I'm not using it in that way. I'm using it as far more a philosophical way of an understanding and approach in psychology, where you're concerned about the realization of human potential and of the conditions that are conducive to its realization, and what impedes it. And so the developmental approach is as opposed to where you put the emphasis on learning on the environment rather than the factors that lead to this unfolding of human potential.
And the idea is that once you're aware of potential, then you'll know what's missing in someone who's not reaching their potential.
Absolutely. It changes totally the way you look at things, because when you have an idea of the model in your own head of how things should unfold, of what we're capable of as human beings, what our brains are capable of, what a 7 or 8 year old, what a 15 year old is capable of, and what would really be there if human potential was unfolding. And then when you look through this lens, it immediately lets you know what is missing, and to know what needs to be restored for potential to be realized. So it's a completely different way of seeing, and rather than being blinded by the symptoms of immaturity and of stuckness, you actually can sense the deficits that are there, and then look to what blocked that potential being realized.
So give us a practical example so that when parents are thinking about this, that when they look at their kids, they're wondering, what exactly does he mean by that?
Well, one of the easiest ways in terms of understanding potential is that as the brain develops, its capacity to mix things, both information from the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere through the bridge, the corpus callosum, and the bridge, and the mixing bowl of emotions, the prefrontal cortex, which is so much the focus of study today in neuroscience, that this is really the finishing touch of development. It's in the mixing, cognitive dissonance, as Piaget explored it, or the mixing of emotions, as we're more concerned about today, and being able to say part of me feels this way and part of me feels that way, is so absolutely central to balance, to stability, to be self-control, to tempered relating, to civilized and considerate relating. When you know what should be, that a child should be able to say, a child past 6 or 7 years of age should be able to say, on the other hand, that part of me feels this way and part of me feels that way, that I have mixed feelings, that should be there. You should see emotional discord. That if you don't see it, that then you realize, oh my goodness, that is the reason we're having problems with impulsiveness, lack of self-control, untempered behavior, and so on and so on.
So you don't expect to see that in, a 3 or 4 year old, and yet we do have kids that are being diagnosed with ADHD and these kinds of disorders that young.
This is the tragedy, is that our clinicians, our the medical profession is not being informed at all about these developmental issues. And so their idea is simply that if you go in and you can intervene early, you can start treating it early, when in actual fact, most of these issues are issues of development. The brain, the development has its seasons, and there isn't a 3-year-old in the world who can say part of me feels this way and part of me feels that way. And one of the problems is that as you get into the 4-year-old, the 3-year-old, these individuals, the number of children who qualify for diagnosis absolutely escalates. And those from the disease approach are thrilled because they say, oh, look, it's prevalence. We can get in there and we can treat early. Whereas those of us that are developmentalists, we just absolutely are appalled that there is no regard for the developmental process today. We've never known more about how children develop, and that's never informed the individuals who actually deal with this less.
So tie that up for us a little bit. So if there's a 6 or 7 year old that you have in front of you and they're able to have these mixed feelings, how does that impact their hyperactivity, for instance, or their ability to focus?
Focusing requires a two-dimensional processing. You have to be able to, it gives it depth in the vision. And immaturity in the vision is there is no depth at all. It's one-dimensional. You either see this or you see that. When you can see both this and that, you have a foreground and a background. You have depth. You have memory. You have a back in the, of the mind, you could say. And all of these things are actually a result of the maturing processes. And so a lot of attention problems are simply immaturity in the attentional system. So, for instance, in an attention deficit disorder, we have distractibility, we have impulsiveness, and we have restlessness. And the impulsivity is directly related to the lack of this mixed feelings, this lack of integrative functioning. And the distractibility can very well be related. There's other issues that can be involved as well. But certainly every 3-year-old is distractible. We use that to manage them. All we have to do is it's so easy to distract them away from something else because they have no ability to be able to hold on to or to attend to two things at the same time.
And you mentioned that as that 3-year-old develops, those skills unfold as they mature. And that to believe that requires a pretty positive view of human nature and of instinct. So you're not talking about how you have to teach kids skills to move them away from the negative instinct, but it's about removing things that are blocking their natural positive instinct.
Well, you've really nailed it. This is exactly the issue. It requires a trust in the developmental process. It requires a belief in the unfolding nature of our potential. And so this is exactly what the issue is. If there's no trust in this, then there's no support for it. And then we try and push and pull You know, if gardeners did this, it would be dreadful. You've got to trust in the natural process that if you provide the right conditions, the fruit will come, the flower will come. And we're not doing this in terms of humans. And if that analogy is true in gardening, how much more is it true in terms of human growth and development?
So what does that mean for those learning people who talk about rewards and consequences as being the primary motivator?
Well, it's very cynical. It suggests that there's no really innate desire to be good in a child, and the reasons are is that they'll work for pleasure. It ends up that the reward system in the brain is actually part of the attachment system, and it's a depersonalized part of it. And so when we really are understanding it, it would be much more natural for a child to want to be good and to experience that sense of fulfillment in the context of those that they're attached to. It's a natural desire to do this. To use a reward is a lack of trust in this process, and you certainly feel it with your own children. When your children love you, And you know that you have their hearts, you can feel that desire from them to be good for you. And when you actually use rewards and trinkets, so to speak, you're actually suggesting that their attachments to things are more important than their attachment to you. And it is. It's a lack of faith in their own natural desire to be good for you.
You know, there's lots of parents out there that have been convinced over the years that these behavioral techniques like time out and taking some prized possessions away from their kids are essential to managing the behavior that they see in their kids. You know, there's these programs like 1-2-3 Magic, there's TV shows like Super Nanny. Like, what can you say to these parents that have been convinced over the years of these alternative ways of doing things?
I don't know. I try. If I, you know, through my book, I try to restore parents to their natural intuition. You have to realize that many of these theories were by men and not by women who had they were one step removed from their own children. John Locke had so little regard for emotion that he considered it, much of this learning theory is based upon John Locke and logical positivism in the 17th century, and he had so little regard for emotion that was, if children were over-emotional and cried, that he considered it a justification to punish them, to strap them. Corporal punishment for this, and of course Skinner, we know his history with his own daughter and the granddaughter and the suicide attempts and so on. All of that has been written and exposed. I think you have to somewhat consider where the theories come from, and that they came from a place where children were not well attached to the theorists who were actually trying to make sense of their world, and so it was one step removed, and they built theories around their own experience. That's what everybody does, and unfortunately, their experience was not a very warm one.
So obviously, in a more developmental approach, the emotional piece is a part of all of that. But you're talking about maturation and how kids will develop over time in a natural way if there's not anything blocking or interfering with that. So what needs to be there for kids to become mature?
Well, what is required first and foremost is an invitation to exist in the presence of the one that they're attached to. That is absolutely essential. The child must believe that, because the attachment needs are the most powerful preeminent needs, and a child needs a certain amount of release, just like release from the need for physical food, from hunger. A child needs release from that, and so the construct of rest is important. All growth emanates from rest. This is true on the physical level. This is true on the psychological level. And so what children work for most is contact and connection, love and belonging. And that's where, as parents, we have the greatest challenge to be able to give them rest. It's all paradoxical. You know, as adults, we work at everything we get. And an actual growth and maturation and realizing of potential is actually from a sense of rest. When a plant can finally rest in terms of its attachment roots, when it's found its nurturance, and then the growth begins to happen. But as long as it's still striving for that attachment, all the energy goes into the root system.
If you're not feeling connected, your alarm bells start to go off, your body starts to react to that because it's such a fundamental need.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can see how that alarm, now we're understanding the stress response is really an alarm response. And the fear response as an alarm response, and how we're most alarmed when we're facing separation. So that's absolutely true. But the more and more we pursue our own answers, our own contact and connection, the more frenzied we become, the more restless we become, the more alarmed we become, because we can't actually meet our own needs there. That's why it's so important to provide rest for a child.
So what should parents keep in mind then if they're thinking about providing this proper atmosphere for this naturally occurring growth and maturation? What is it that parents should be doing? What is it that can help their child grow naturally and mature naturally this way?
The most significant element is to provide the contact, the connection, the love, belonging. As one developmentalist says, every single child needs an adult in their life that is absolutely crazy about them. Mm. And you know, that you can just feel the truth in that is that is where the child comes to rest and where growth begins, where the striving ends, at least situationally. And so it's parents assuming the responsibility to provide, to actually be, not have the answers for their children, but to be the answer with regards to their attachment needs, their needs for contact and connection and belonging and love. It is taking that position, and that is what is missing so much nowadays, is we're so focused on our children behaving and fitting in. The very last stage of development is for the child to become fit for society. But all of this needs the raw material to be refined, and that raw material is a result of a child being able to become their own person, which is only possible when their attachment needs are somewhat fulfilled.
So there might be parents thinking that creating a secure attachment with their child means fulfilling their every wish as a way to show their love, or maybe being their child's best friend. But that's not really what we're talking about, is it?
No, it's not talking about that at all. In fact, you have to differentiate between what their demands are and what their needs are. And the parent needs to provide more than the child pursues in terms of their own needs. But it's not a matter of indulging a child's wishes or desires, or it's not even a matter of keeping the child from upset. It's a matter of assuming responsibility for being the source of contact and connection, for being the compass point, being the one who in a sense is the anchor point for the child.
So shared activities become an important part of all of that, right? How important are things like family dinners and family game nights and those other kinds of activities that bring the kids and the parents together?
Well, we need a liturgy of family. That's absolutely essential. We've lost the traditions and structures. We've lost the rituals that actually allow us to be able to create the kinds of connections and to actually be that answer for love and belonging. That is what is in danger in our society today. The sit-down meals are so important. This is the way we did family. That this was absolutely essential to our family. is the sit-down meals. I don't know how families can do it when they don't actually have the traditions that bring that fulfilling togetherness, where you don't collect your children, you don't get their eyes, their smiles and the nods, you don't share your stories, they don't have a sense of being seen from the inside out. That is absolutely essential. It's not necessary to play with your children. It's not the playing in itself that is the activity. What is necessary is to be with. That being with is absolutely essential.
So you talk about collecting. This is a term maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with, but tell us a bit more about that. And one of the phrases that stuck with me when we saw you doing your workshop was giving the child or any person really an invitation to exist. Tell us about that.
Well, this is the most important invitation that any child could ever have and experience. In fact, even us as adults, we long for this invitation to exist in the presence of those that are important to us, that we're attached to, and this is our primary hunger. And so, when we understand this from children, our challenge is to answer it. Now, one of the ways that you nurture attachment is that you actually engage the attachment instincts. And the greeting is the best way of being able to see this. And the greeting in most cultures is some variation of collecting the eyes, collecting a smile, which is actually an indication of that invitation to exist in one's presence. And then a nod, which is an indication of agreement, which is actually part of attachment. And by collecting those things, it massages you into the kind of activities in which you're actually activating the attachment in the other person. And so having that as the yearning in you with regards to your children, and having it bring you to actual activities in which collecting happens, creates the context then in which you can actually raise that child so much more intuitively, effectively, and with so much more ease.
You know, and that's something that's really real. Like you can see when you're connecting with a child, when they really have felt that invitation to be present, they sit up in their seat, they get closer to you. There's a kind of a warmth that actually happens there. And something that really stuck with me was connect then direct. Tell
yes.
us about that.
Well, yes. Well, It turns out that children are born actually to, they're meant to be difficult. they're not born to do our bidding. It turns out that we are much like other mammals, is that we only feel like being good for those to whom we're attached. And in the context of attachment, this is true for our pets, our cats, our dogs, our horses, and so on, monkeys. It's true, and it's that there's an actual instinct to resist the will of the other if our attachment instincts aren't engaged. And a psychologist, Otto Rank, gave a term for this counterwill over 100 years ago, and I think it absolutely fits perfectly, that we instinctively resist the will of those when our attachment instincts are not engaged. And so let's say if you go to your child first thing in the morning, and before you've engaged their attachment instincts, before you've got the eyes and the smile and the nod, you say to your child, come on, hurry up now, we've got to go, get out of bed, come on, quick. You can actually sense your child slowing down, working mm-hmm. to rule, resisting you. And you can feel it in yourself if somebody, you know, approaches you this way. And that's the point, is that we're not meant to be able to work with, we're not meant to work with children outside the context of engagement, of engaged attachment instincts. And that's why it's so important to collect them, to get the eyes, a smile, and a nod, before we attempt to influence them, to get them to set the table, to do their homework, to solicit a good intention. And we do this automatically with our friends. And most of us do it with adults, But this is one of the things we've lost, our attachment manners. We've lost these intuitive understandings with children. We think that simply because we have the role of a teacher, a parent, a foster parent, a daycare provider, we can just tell children what to do. And it absolutely backfires.
And that idea of collecting has huge implications for teachers, maybe teachers especially, but for coaches too and other adults who are working with kids.
Absolutely. If you look at those that you would intuitively say, there goes a child whisperer, you know, you can sense some of them. There's the coaches, there's the teachers who you just wonder, oh my goodness, they're a Pied Piper. Just look at this. Look at the way they have their way with the children. And you look at them, and that's exactly what they're doing, they're not, they don't have to lord it over. They don't have to be overly commanding. Or you just see the way they work and the way they are able to collect the children. And in the context of that collection, children are naturally, their natural desire is to be able to measure up, to attend, to do their bidding. This can absolutely transform a home. It can transform a classroom. It can transform a residence program. If you want something that's magic, this is where the real magic lies.
And those connected teachers are the ones that kids remember forever, for the rest of their lives when they look back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And those teachers don't have to use heavy-handed discipline. When you have the natural motivation of a desire, desire in a child to be good for you, you really have all you need to be able to work with a child. It doesn't mean that they can be good all the time, but it does mean that they're at least leaning in the right direction.
And that's the end of part one of our interview with Dr. Gordon Neufeld. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. Tune in 2 weeks for part two of our interview with Dr. Neufeld, where we'll be talking much more about discipline and how to deal with the problems that children have when they get stuck. As usual, we'll leave you tonight with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, and he's over at BrotherLoveRocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
So get up and sing, just like we used to do. Yeah, cause it's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do.
FamilyAnatomy.com.